Okay, let's say that we'll begin. And tonight, I wanted to address the basic structure of kashrus that we have here in Israel. The whole system, the various forms, and the beginning of the discussion into the various levels of mahad and regular. And Rahim goes to the main details, but to get a sense of what's basically mahad. By way of contrast, many of us will either come from the States or from England, whereas in America I know, that the kashla, I said many of us. Okay? Right? And America, for example, we have a few major kashrut organizations, national kashrut organizations. Most well known of them is OU. Then you also have the Chavkei, the Starkei, okay? A number of 5, 10. Then you have some other triangle K, moon K, half moon K, more and more are starting. But you have a certain core group of basic hashkafas. Then you have also, pretty much in each locality, you have basically the Vad, who is responsible for the local pizza shop, or the local restaurant, the local whatever, if it's in Flatbush, the Vad Flatbush, in Queens, Vad Queens, whatever, if it's in Chicago, the Vad Chicago. You have basically, in each community, you have the basic Vad. And therefore, in America, we thought that the kashrut is relatively simple. We have the general exception. We have the vads. Some vads were better, some vads were not as good. But basically, that was pretty much it. In England, you have also, you have the cup you have there. And again, you have a few basic kashrut organizations, whether it be the Vadat of London, the KF, or the Manchester, whatever it was. They have a few basic kashrut organizations. And again, there's a limit to how many there were. And if you go to other places like South Africa, so you have even less. Okay, I think there's just one or two, basically. What? One. Okay, so it's basically in that sense, it's either approved by that or it's not approved by that. So a kashrut was relatively simple. Either it's approved or it's not approved. In Australia, I understand that even there, the kashrut is even less than in South Africa. And a lot of it worked by a list. It didn't even have kashrut so much on the products, but that's a list of known that certain products were deemed acceptable and certain were not. On the other hand, when you talk about in terms of Eretz Yisrael, so we have Kanai Nahara, we have many, 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 many hashkafos, both national hashkafos, and also we have also the Rabbanut Hashkafos, we have Rabbanut of this city, and that city, and the other city, and this Ezor, and this Ezor, with Mahad, with Kashrut Gilah, and we begin to get very, very confused as to what's going on. I just saw there was an organization, the Fiscal Kashrut organization, put out a very good magazine, and they just put out a booklet of all the Orthodox Hashkafas. I think there were up to 2,000 worldwide Hashkafas, but 2,000 Kashrut organizations worldwide. Just to give you a sense of what's happened, because it's become, in addition to just the basic providing service of Kashrut, it has also become like any other area. It's become a certain business area, and therefore also people are, well, why not go into Hashkafas and go into any other business, go into the Hashkafa business, and therefore it has been increasing over time. Well, if one doesn't like it, this kashrut does this, that one's a little bit better, which is good. Okay, so therefore we've seen a tremendous, tremendous increase in the number of kashrut organizations, and I'd like to try to make a little bit of order in terms of how things go. Let's backtrack 50, 60 years when the state was established. So the basic question then in terms of what to do with the kashrut. As the country is developing, what do you want to do? We have the chief rabbinate of Israel. And there was a major dilemma in terms of what you want to do with kashrut. And that dilemma continues throughout the generations and continues now also in a certain sense. And that is, where do you want to target your kashrut, your hashkafa? Do you want to do something, and we mentioned it briefly last week, similar to like public education? Do you want to have something which kashrut will try to provide for as many people as possible, ensuring that as many eateries, as many factories, as many food plants will be able to receive a hashkafa? At the same time, if you want to do that, both in terms of manpower and in terms of the degree that you can enforce things and the degree that you can reasonably expect people to be interested in applying for the hashkafa, you have to, in a certain sense, take basic minimal standards which you think you can basically uphold, because if you try to understand this too hard, then people will not be interested, people will not be confident, people will not be able to decide, I just can't afford it, it's too much, and therefore people will decide, look, forget it, I'll just run my risk and I won't have any, and I'll go without any hashgacha. And therefore you may have a higher standard of hashgacha, however you will have many places where there will be no hashgacha at all. Or do you try to make a hashgacha something which is available to everybody, which is convenient, which is reasonably priced, which is something where you can afford to have a mashgiach go around numerous places, not just be focused on one place, and therefore spread the wage of the mashgiach over numerous eateries, in which case you have a somewhat lower standard, however you're able to provide for many, many companies. So this is an issue which the Talmud state began, and the decision was to try to enable as much of Israel as possible to be kosher at the price that necessarily we would not have all the standards that necessarily that would be ideally required to keep a certain basic level, certain for the status quo of certain dubious kosher, but to spread it width-wise necessarily as opposed to necessarily depth. And that was the idea, the basic idea of the kosher organization. To give a real example of this, was a very interesting machlokas that comes up in the Sitz Eliyahu, had a discussion. There was a hotel who applied for a hashgacha, but they told the rabbanut, listen, we want the kitchen to be kosher, however, we want the freedom to serve the guests milchik and then fleishik right afterwards, or possibly even simultaneously if they want, but they're not going to quote unquote trace up anything in the kitchen. All the cooking will be kosher, the food will be kosher, the food will be served will be kosher. However, if a guest wants to have coffee with milk right after his meat, or I don't know, perhaps even if he wants to take some cold butter and put it on his meat sandwich, the mashgiach will allow them to do so. Can they give a hashgacha to such a hotel where the hotel is telling ahead of time, we're going to keep the kitchen and the cooking kosher? But the mashgiach will have to overlook the fact that we'll be serving possibly milk right after, or perhaps even simultaneously with the meal. That was the question that was posed to the Sitz Eliezer. Can we allow such a place to have a hashgach on that? And the approach of the Sitz Eliezer was absolutely not. They have the standards we have to uphold. This is something which is us, which cannot be done. And we can't give the hotel a kosher certification so that people will come and think that what's happening in the hotel is halakhically kosher, and then they're going to serve milk, and then right after they're going to have, they'll have fleishos, and they'll have milk with cake right after for avochat adav and lunch at 2, and then avochat adav will have milk with cake right after. And people think, well, if it's under the hashgacha, it must be halakhically permitted. And therefore, we can, in a certain sense, give up on the proper halakhic kosher principles. We are at the risk, if the cost of the hotel will step on, so we're not going to get certification. So that, look, we have a responsibility to uphold standards. We can't ruin standards in order to. He gives a famous example, which they quote, which unfortunately was happened hundreds of years ago, and the same discussion came up recently in the States with the outbreak of AIDS. It was a question of possibly should we try to legalize and have formalized places of, let's call it, ill repute, so that way we have better hygiene and control. And so the same thing happened hundreds of years ago, and unfortunately there were goyim and goyis, and the question of should they allow to have some sort of control and sort of try to limit to make sure, whatever. And they said, surely, b'shem panim v'ofen, no, you can't by doing so, you're giving almost an official stamp to this. And that was the opinion of the Sitz Eliezer. Rav Avadia Yosef responded to him that he thought that we should give the hotel the kashrus. He said, look, people, because it's not just people who are not caring about kashrus, you have good intentioned people who come, visitors who come to Eretz Yisrael, who are not necessarily to learn, and they think in Eretz Yisrael everything is kosher, and they assume they come to a hotel, and they see people walking around, Jews walking around, they assume naturally that the hotel here is kosher, and if we don't give the hotel kashrus, then they'll end up, who knows what, because the hotel will have no kashrus, no supervision at all. And people will come, and good intentioned people, it's not just people who don't care about kashrus, people who do care about kashrus, but assume that here at Eretz Yisrael everything is kosher, and therefore we need to at least provide some degree of control of kashrus over the hotel. And look, those who are careful about nozzles should know well enough that if they just have pleasure, but they shouldn't have nozzles right afterwards. Okay, and we can't for you people who will not care about it and will have the course with smoke right after the meat, we don't have to take responsibility for that. But it's better to protect the innocent, well-intentioned people from the more serious issues of milk and meat being cooked together, having milk in the chicken soup or in the shalom itself. And so this is an example of the machlokes which came from Sri Chaitanya and Radio Sage on this kind of issue. I saw it in articles, it seemed like a fictitional, but the Sefer El HaMakorot, which also Surah Rahim, raised this same kind of issue, a fictional story of a new Rav who comes to take the Rav ear, and he's again, first day, and then accomplished, learned Rav ear, he walks into the office, it's down the first day, and a certain Beit Havra'ah comes over, and they want to do that kashrut. The rabbi said, okay, well, tell me a little about what you have. Tell me about your kitchen. I'll send over some to inspect. I was talking to him. He said, okay, so look, we'll have to have your kitchen non-stop. We'll have to have a mashgiach, two shifts of mashgiachim. Right? And the person who's in charge of the resort said, well, it's going to cooperate. I said, look, it's mashgiach, which is saying it's going to come pretty thing. What's going on here? I can't afford such a thing. I'll think about it. But he calls up the local and my son, maybe we can get some funding for this. No, my son here has no money either. We're strapped already to the very, we have absolutely no money to give, there's no way we can get anything of this stuff. So he says, well, let me see if I can sell. So he calls up one, again, sort of fictional, so he calls up one and says, you know, look, I had the same issue. When I took over this city, I decided with kashrus is going to have to be kept up to the standards. And I can't give, how can I rightfully give kashrus to a place where I'm not going to eat? If I can't eat there, then I can't sign my name to the kashrus in that place. And therefore it was very hard for me and I had battles. But that's what I, my principle, and I held up to it. How can I go up to Shamayim and I'm going to say that they're going to say, hey, you let people eat here, and something which is not kosher. Calls up another Rav, and he says, you know what? And the Rav tells him, you know, what can I do? How can I go up to Shamayim? If I had the same issue, and I try to make sure that every organization, every restaurant in the city can have some sort of hashgacha. Because if I don't make sure every restaurant has hashgacha, chas v'shalom, I'm going to go up to Shemayim after they have Essim, and they're going to ask me, how did you let the city, how did you let the city not have kashrus, and there were people in your city who were eating treif, and eating chazan, and eating who knows what, because you were worried about the tail. So this is, again, this is a fictional story, but it sort of has this dilemma of where do you want to aim, how do you aim the kashrus, in terms of do you want to spread it as wide as possible, or do you want to try to aim for the highest standards. And therefore, what I think is important to emphasize, that's one of the things I would like to come out of this whole issue, is to realize, and it would be very nice to be able to come here and say, okay, Rabbi, here's our list. Kashrus X, kashrus Y, kashrus Z, product X, product Y, okay or not okay? Let's go. One, V or X? No, product two, kashrus V or X? It's not so simple, and I can't really give, and no one can really give a very, very clear answer to everything, you know, just run down the list. This yes, this no, this yes, this no, this yes, this no. Because there is a whole variety, there is a lot, it's not black and white, there's a lot of gray in kashrus. So what's the goal of the series of shiurim is to try to clarify the gray as much as possible to understand where things are. And as we mentioned last week, to a certain extent, situations both in terms of family and financial and availability, all these come factors into where in the gray to try to find a line in terms of this. The kashrus as it stands, basically in 1983, a law was passed in the Knesset. It's called Kol Kana'at Kashrut, the law of Hona'ah is deception, okay, in kashrus, and therefore there was connected with the law path that only the Rabbanut HaRashid has the authority, has the right to declare something as kosher. If you want to put a tag kosher on something, you have to have tzedak kashrut. It must have the authority. Only the Rabbanut HaRashid is authorized. The Rabbanut HaRashid is also only they're authorized, or their representatives are authorized to give. It is considered an illegal act to put the word kosher on something which does not have authorization of the Rabbanut HaRashit. On the other hand, the word Mahadran has no legal meaning. There is no legal definition, and you can put the word Mahadran on whatever you want, and no one can take it to task, because there is no definition of Mahadran. Kosher is illegal to pass, it's not authorized by the Rabbanut. The word Mahadran has no meaning, and because of that, in a sense, the standards of Mahadran can be anywhere to anything, and anyone could decide big open organization called Mahajan, Mahajan. You know Mahajan now? No, no, no. Supermarket. Okay, you want to convert it to Mahajan or Mahajan? Oh, that's always better. You say kosher. Kosher you can't say unless you are authorized by the Rabbanut. And therefore, the Rabbanut has the responsibility of maintaining, as I mentioned, a certain basic minimum standard of kosher throughout the country, and the goal of the Rabbanut itself is, as I mentioned, to try to make it as widely available as possible with a basic minimum, again, depends on what. As the years go by, the kashrus scheme does advance somewhat, and the Rabbanut is also increasing its standard across. Therefore, this is approach, and therefore, the basic definition, the basic idea of Rabbanut, of every hashgacha has to have a rabbanut. And that's why you will see on all the products in Israel, okay, even if you have many mahajan hashgachos, you will always see at the bottom or somewhere, bashalat harabanut, whatever. Because every product has got to have an authorization, a basic conscious authorization of the rabbanut or its one of its representatives on everything. Similarly, on things which are imported, as well, the Rabbanut has to have issued, the Rabbanut has to provide an authorization to import, even if it has the best hashgacha and chutzah, it doesn't make a difference. Every product which is brought in, which is, I don't know whether it's every product or a product which wants to be served as kosher, I don't know whether it's legal to import the unkosher things or not, but again, anything which is imported and sent to kosher has got to have the authorization. You can't just say, well, it has the Manchester, whatever it is from the... Okay, it has to have an authorization from the OU to be imported, imported here in Israel as kosher. This is the level, a basic level of the government. This is the basic bottom tier of the kashrus organization. Israel is a rabbanut authorization for the class. Yeah.
The rabbanut of Israel, I think, are imported. All the rabbanut of Israel. But they have, like, Rabbanut
Yerushalayim,
they
have
other cities.
Okay.
How do they...
Okay, so excellent. It's an excellent point. It's a very, very important point. And that is one of the pluses, and at the same time, minuses of this system, is that the Rabbanut is a national organization, and as such, it has national mutual responsibility. Meaning that the fact that it's fully across the board allows it to have certain standards that it can impose throughout the country. At the same time, it is a stipulation, no rabbanut, as long as something, a product, is declared kosher by another rabbanut, it must be accepted by all other rabbaniot. Okay, again, we're talking about that. So therefore, for example, we know people who had a hotel in Yerushalayim, and they once sent back with them a package of chicken soup. Right, so it's a hotel in Yerushalayim, under the kashrut of Rabbanut of Yerushalayim. I looked at the package of chicken soup, and I don't remember if it was kefir or lach. Okay, so the chicken soup, even the chicken soup that you're serving, although it's not, even though this hotel is in Yerushalayim, but the chicken soup was not chicken soup of Rabbanut Yerushalayim, but it was chicken soup of kefir or of lach. So therefore, there is a certain issue here, that the Rabbanut, since it is a mutual national organization, it has to accept anything from any other Rabbanut, regardless, and the Rabbanut is, again, on Kashrut Rigila, is not allowed to say, well, you know, we here in our city, we have our top of things, we have good mashgiachim, and we have high standards. That other place, I don't know, and therefore we're not going to allow it into our kitchen. A Rabbanut, Kashrut Rigila, is not allowed to do that. They must accept in anything from any other rabbin.
Does that mean the
Rabbanut
Yerushalayim is the same as the
Rabbanut
in any part of the country because
that
they're accepting it?
Well, as I said, that means that Rabbanut Yerushalayim can have, as I said, just to give you an example, they can be serving chicken soup, which essentially is under the hashgacha of Rabbanut Haifa. Now, however, there is a certain advantage because there are many things, and that's important, which are not, there's the raw product, and then there is the local, how on top of things you are. Let's say, for example, the Trumas HaMaisos. Trumas HaMaisos is basically taken care of by the local Rabbanot in each community. Okay, so you would assume that in a community where the Rabbanot is, for example, Rabbanot Yerushalayim, the Mashgichim who are in charge of the Trumas HaMaisos will be more on top of the Trumas HaMaisos than perhaps some other Rabbanot. So if you're dealing with a local palace, for example, if you're talking about, say, in terms of sifting the flour and stuff like that, you assume that Rabbanot Rechol, but other Rabbanot that are more on top of things, things that are made locally, okay, well, again, the raw product can come from anywhere, but you can be more assured that what the work which is being done in the immediate vicinity, the better Rabbanot will be presumably more on top of than a forsaken kind of Rabbanot. So there is a certain sense, so, and this is important to mention, that when you talk, and this is what I want, one of the things that I'd like to emphasize, when you talk in terms of kashrus, there are a number of issues which have to be addressed. One is the raw product, where they're coming from. And two is how much the mashgiach is available. This is one of the big issues when we talk about mahajin versus regular kashrus, is the availability and the amount of time that the mashgiach will spend in whatever food establishment. And this is perhaps one of the biggest differences. This is, I don't know, one of the, it's probably the biggest. That if you take, and this is one of the, I was looking through the Rabbanut, has a very beautiful Agaf HaKashrut, a beautiful website which has all the various branches, and they have in each one of the branches, they have Nahalim, has a manual of the guidebook that the Mashgichim are supposed to adhere to when giving to the Kashrut. And they have, in each Nahalim, whether they have for restaurants and for butchers and for hotels and for hospitals, they're very beautiful. For each organization, for each kind of conscious, it has a whole manual of the standards that they're both expect in each of these establishments. And it has, certain things in the bottom of the asterisk, which is mahajan. Okay, meaning there are certain, has the rules, and here and there, there are a few, okay? There are a few different standards where it is demanded not for regular kashrut, but for mahajan. I just, as an example, I printed off some. Let's say, for example, in terms of shefting, how fast can you shef chickens? Okay, so actually when it comes to chickens, I really apparently have three levels. The highest level I call chalak, then mahajan, the middle level, and then kashrut regila. So I write as follows. For chalak, the highest level, you can do only 10 chickens a minute. Whereas for kashrut kasher and mahajan, you can do 12. Okay? You have certain differences which are not halachic per se, but it's a question of how careful you are. Or for example, how often do you have to check the knife? So it says for halach, every two cases, which is about 5 minutes, you have to check the knife. For mahajin, every three cases, about 8 minutes. And every for kosher, every four cases, about 10 minutes. This is one of few, an example of a difference in the manual between. Okay, the question of this is not per se a halachic machloket. Okay, it's not a question. There is no rule as to how you can do as fast as you want to mark the shofet is able to properly cut. Right? How fast the shofet properly cut depends on his expertise, depends how fresh he is, depends how old he is. Okay, but here you have an example of where, although it's not a defined halachic issue, but there's a certain degree, extra degree of care built in for the better hashgacha, but of course this comes with a certain cost, because if the mashgiach, let's say the chalak as opposed to the kashir, can only have to check the knife, and he can only do, first of all, 10 as opposed to 12 minutes, so he's already 60% less efficient, he also has to then check his knife twice as much, so obviously all this means that in terms of manpower it's going to be more. Another example in terms of the liver, kashrut liver. Okay, so the discussor has various, has a whole manual how to kasher liver. Then it says for mahajan, you can only kasher liver on an open flame. Okay, that's an example of a difference between, right, and not that you can't use the closed fires or electric fires, it has to be on an open flame. Or for example, talks here in terms of bakeries. How thick a sifter, right, how fine does the sifter have to be? So you use the quote called meshing it. What is it? It's a density, how many per whatever. So I said in regular kashrus there has to be at least 50 mesh, okay, 50 per whatever it is, and for mahadrin it has to be at least 60 per. Right? So you have to scale out the book because you have differences of different levels of different requirements. Some are issues of machlokas. For example, you talk about milk powder. Okay, milk powder called machlokas, which is a big machlokas. It has gone goes back 100 years. Can you allow milk powder from even if you use, assuming that you can't use cholos, if you can't use cholos, which is not called Yisrael, can you use milk powder, which is not called Yisrael? This is a halachic machlokas. So this is an example where Kashrut does allow it, relying on whether they have gelatin, okay, which was a less of an issue now than the other ones. Also doesn't allow gelatin from non-kosher, has to put gelatin from kosher animals or fish. But there was a time that gelatin was even from non-kosher, relying on the opinion. So you have one issue where there is a halachic machloket, l'chula or l'chuma. So what the Kashrut may rely on the leaning's opinion, the Mahajan will follow the more stricter approach. You have other issues, such as we just mentioned, which are not halachas machlokasim, but it's a question of how careful are you going to be on whatever it is. Are you going to shaft this stance or that stance? Are you going to acquire this stance, or you're going to acquire a finer distance? As I said though, the biggest issue is the availability of the mashgiach. Because it's very nice that you have a manual which tells you that you're supposed to be doing this, and you're supposed to be doing this, and you're supposed to be doing this, and mashgiach, and only this is for the mashgiach, only this is for the mashgiach. What is that? I took a tour a few months ago from a mashgiach from Angadera, and there are a few things basically that only the mashgiach, what is the basic job, what is the mashgiach supposed to do? Mashgiach is supposed to do, first of all, to check the product, right, to make sure that all the products have kosher certification. The mashgiach is then responsible for or checking that if they're fruits and vegetables, that everything comes properly stamped, that it has enough sugar from after taken. He's responsible for sifting the flour, he's responsible for checking the rice and the beans and whatever. He's responsible for washing the leafy greens, he's responsible also for checking the eggs. Okay, so these are jobs that only the mashgiach is supposed to do. Now, if the mashgiach comes in, only once a day, okay? So you're hoping that when he comes in the morning and they need him to check the eggs or check the rice or whatever it is, that he does enough and will last the day, and that if they run out, they're supposed to call him and say, please come back because we need you to do more. Okay? Will they not? Yeah. Hard to say. You hope? Yes. Whereas if the Ashkaga Mahajan Ashkaga require a more on-site mashiach will either come more times, or the mashgiach will often be there non-stop, and especially in the establishment, so that these issues come up less so. Now again, halachically, there is a reliance, you're allowed to have mashgiach going in and out, so there is basis, this, and certainly you know, you and all the hashgachs will end up going in and out. But again, the availability of the mashgiach, you'll know from the houses that things, sometimes mistakes happen, and certainly the more the mashgiach is unpleasant, the more he's likely able to be able to catch them. For example, in Gedera, there is no Mahajan. Why is there no Mahajan in Gedera? Very simply, because Mahajan, as you mentioned, there is no official rule, and therefore every organization wants to decide Mahajan can set up the standards that they deem proper to be required for Mahajan. So therefore, Rabbi Yerushalayim will have this stance for Mahajan, so Rabbi will require this, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Yamin will require this, and Rabbi Tafula will have this, and Rabbi Dimona will have this, and Rabbi Tafula will have this, and Rabbi Tafula will have this. Each, because that's already a standard, which is not legally defined, and each one can set up a standard. The Rav of Gedera is insistent that anything which is Mahajan has to have a non-star, has to have what we call Mashiach community. You can't have Mashiach who goes in and out, who makes the round. Any establishment that wants to have, who wants to have a Shafa, which is going to be under his name, with Mahajan, that's fine, no problem. But you must have a Mashiach there non-stop. And unfortunately, Gedera is not that big a town, and therefore there's no eatery in a Gedera who sees the financial viability of supporting on their own a Mashiach, and that's why in Gedera there is no Mahajan in Gedera, because no one can afford the Mashiach's meat, and the Rabbi is insistent that he will not authorize a Mahajan without that.
Didn't you say earlier
Mahajan is not defined? Correct. It's not defined legally, but the Rav, and that's why each, whoever is giving it, so the Rav of Gedera, he feels that to be called Mahajan, you have to have an outside Mashiach. And he is not willing to give his field of Mahajan Gedera unless you have key fields to that. To him, that's a basic standard. And therefore, he will not allow any Rabban Gedera to give issue of Mahajan Hashkaha without the presence of Mashiach Midi. Now, this has, of course, its pluses and its minuses. Right? The plus is that if there were to be a Mahajan, then you would be ensured the Mashiach has done all the time. But the flip side, as we mentioned, because of that insistence, basically all of Gedera works only with Kashrut Gedera. So basically in some places the Mashiach is more on top, some less on top, but there is no even medium kind of Mahajan Gedera because of this insistence of applying a, this goes back to the dilemma that we posed earlier of how much do you want to keep standards, the high standards, aim for the high standards. At the course of, if you don't reach them, where are you left? Yeah.
No, it's just that you mentioned Gedera, which is one of our nearest localities. And you mentioned, and a lot of people say this to me, that there are some rabbis that are on top of their game, and there are some rabbis mm-hmm. that are sacred, I think you use the word forsaken, or, you know, they're not on top of their game. And people always say to me, well, okay, Yerushalayim must be okay, or Rehovot must be okay, big city, it's got Rakuk, whatever, but Gedera actually went to Malachi, small places. They make a value judgment on the Rabbanot of the small places. You've seen it there. So, is it forsaken? I mean, I'm trying to understand what the forsaken Rabbanot actually is.
Okay. Right. Here again comes a tricky answer, and that is, okay, let's say for example, you have a certain, as mentioned last week, you have a Kupat Cholim. Okay? You want to know how good is the Kupat Cholim in Yad Vashem? Okay, now how many doctors have a Kupat Cholim here? One doctor, right? You want to know, or you go to or trading, you know, you want to know is the Kupat Cholim in this city, is it a good Kupat Cholim or not? Is it a reliable Kupat Cholim? That it depends on the doctor. There are about 5 Mashiachim there in there. Some are better, and some are less so. Okay? The impression overall that as Rabbi knows it's decent. Okay? They seem to be more or less on top of it. Okay? They seem to be more or less. I can't say that there are no mistakes. One of the Mashiach Maharaj showed me his whole log of, you know, one of the establishments where, you know, all the mistakes that he kept. He kept a log of all the things that went wrong. This way, you know, if you see you get too many, you know, you can't just say, well, you know, well, we've had this problem, this problem, this problem. You said, no, no, look, I can document. On this day this happened, this day this happened, this day this happened, this day this happened. But he keeps a log of each thing, so if need be, they have accurate records of things. So the Rabbanut there, again, in general, the impression was that they are, you know, certainly, as Rabbanut go, you know, reasonable, they seem to be more or less on top of things. Again, certain, some Mashiach Medul seem to be a little bit more than others, but it's reasonable. Okay.
What?
What does that mean? Do you want to make sure that if, for example, that the Rambam decides that the Mashiach is supposed to visit the store once a day, or twice a day, or 3 times a day, that in fact it happened? Okay. Now again, that's the decision of the Rav of the city. How often does this establishment have to be visited? But you want to make sure that if it says that this store is supposed to be visited 3 times a day, then in fact it will be visited 3 times a day. If there is a decision that the flower has to be sifted forever, and only Mashiach has to sift the flower, you want to make sure that in fact the flower is being left to the Mashiach to sift. You want to make sure that if it says the fruits and vegetables have to all can't be just bought at your local shuk in Yavne or whatever day, but it has to be bought through the store, through the local, through the main store there, so that way you know that all the fruits and vegetables are being bought from the store that has an ashgacha. You want to make sure that they are ensuring that this is happening and that people aren't popping out and buying fruits and vegetables from wherever the local farmers that they want. Now, this is an example of you want to make sure, and this is that we mentioned, the Nohalim of the Rabbanut. Someone said to me, if the books of those manuals would be kept, the conscience, even the regular conscience, would be gewaldic if those books were all kept. a lot. And that's, for example, when it comes to the Kosharot, which are the organizations which have recently started to come out of Elon Moreh, Rav Moshe Katz, and Kosharot, that they, the story with them, they came to a, when a Bachram was getting married, and walked into the canyon up there, and they started talking to Mashiach. Of course, they couldn't find Mashiach, he wasn't there before. And, you know, they're trying to, like, what's going on there? They decided they can't eat anything at the hotel. At the wedding, they just said the Bokoshi, you know, Shokun Lachmaniya, which is basically the oldest they could have. And then they also know that they started, and they said the goal is not necessarily to undo the Avodah Tzedakah, but to make sure that whatever is supposed to happen is supposed to happen. So when you talk, so that's when you talk about a Rabbanit functioning or not functioning, you want, the question is, to what extent are the rules, are the requirements, are carried out, to what extent the mashgichim are being sincere in their work, making sure that within the limitations of their instructions, obviously the instructions are not the same as a mahajan instruction, but you want to make sure that the instructions they are receiving are in fact being carried out. I'm not going to talk about in terms of the various, and I think this depends, of course, not just on the city, but also from one place to another. You can imagine like a city in Tel Aviv, in Gedera, as I mentioned, about 4 or 5 Mashiachim. You can imagine a city like Tel Aviv, okay, a city like Tel Aviv, where you have many, many more eateries, you probably have a larger staff, and therefore you probably also have, I assume, I may be wrong, but bigger challenges, okay, because your clientele is not the... Right, so you may have, you know, the degree of to what extent the Mashiach, and also the question of the relationship and the rapport that the Mashiach is. One of the issues which is also improving over time is that classically the Mashiach was paid by the owner of the food establishment. Okay, so therefore, obviously the same way that he pays his waiters and he pays his cooks, he also pays his Mashiach. Now if the Mashiach knows that he's being paid by the owner of the establishment, there's a certain cross of interest over here, because he knows that if he makes too many problems, he may find himself without a job. In the Mahajir Hashgachas, almost all of them, the money is paid to the Hashgacha, and from him to the Mashgiach is less, is not as dependent on the local place, because he can report that his responsibility is to report back to the Hashgacha. By law, the Bagas passed, and interesting, because the Kashrus is now under the, in a sense, officially by law, the Bagas has also stuck its noses here and there. One of the things the Bagas decided 2 years ago, which hasn't been put into practice, is that to move away from the system in the Rabbanut as well, that the payment of the Hashgacha should be to the Rabbanut, and the Mashgichim will be paid from the Rabbanut, and this, that, but again, that hopefully will raise the, that will raise the standard of kashrus throughout the country. So these,
so you've been talking about today is the law, especially about the guys who make the laws, the chief rabbi of every place, is appointed by the municipality itself, isn't he?
Yeah.
So actually, in some forsaken place, he could be appointed due to certain interests of the...
Of course, and this is, of course, it's true that obviously each city, the Rav of the city has the ultimate responsibility for the kashrus in that city. Okay, although I would assume that in many, it depends, in some, as I said, in Gedera, the Rav of the city is fairly involved in the kashrus of the city. He is on top of the, so you have the Rabbanut HaRashit, and that is that either some cities have the Rabbanut of the city, or the ones above, the smaller areas don't have a Lashkar Rabbanut, they have a Kodom Moetzah Datit, who is responsible for the local council. The other thing there is fairly involved.
I'm not talking about
right.
There are ones that
right. So obviously, I'm saying, so obviously a city in which the Rav is more, is presumably more there. Well, again, but this is a conscious, and this is important. My example, the Shachman pointed out that very involved building up in Flatbush, the whole Yom Yisrael movement and the conscious. So when you talk about conscious, there are two sides to conscious. Because on the one hand is the Sfarim, the book, which, what is the halacha, what is the Shulchan Aruch, what are the laws. On the other hand, it's also very much the practical end of things. Like you can know all of Hilchos Shechita, But if you haven't sit in a Schlachthaus and you don't know exactly, you know, how to move the knife well, right, so you can tell me all the chakiras and the rav about the five, you know, psulei shechita, right, but when you want to know how to pull a knife, but you've never been in a Schlachthaus, you don't know how to pull a knife. So in order to properly supervise, you have to have both the halakhic knowledge and as well you have to have the practical knowledge, and also not just practical knowledge, but you also have to have a certain amount of savviness to be able, when something is fishy, to be able to know when something is fishy, to be able to catch things that are going on that perhaps shouldn't be happening. Yeah,
you mentioned again, first to call it a galaxy. Okay. In terms of eating, in terms of us being able to make decisions,
right.
You know, most of us, I think, used to eat quite comfortably, our shaka, our homes would be in a lot of that. With exceptions within the big system, how do the rabbin of Gezeira, for example, compare in terms of the way they carry out their kashrut duties to the London Bedlin, to the OU?
Right. So again, this is a million-dollar question, which after 13 years is still struggling with. And the answer is, there is no real answer in this simple sense. Not as for as follows. If you talk about, as I mentioned, there are official standards and there are pragmatic standards. In terms of that, if you follow the book, many of the kashriyot here would, even the regular, would probably be on par with the potential. Some things, yes, some, you know. For example, we spoke about earlier about the speed of the kashering. I think in Kutzlark they go as fast as at least as fast as the kashrut of Gilat, not faster. Okay? So in that sense to say, well look, if I eat that mistake, then here what's the problem? Okay? On the other hand, if, let's say for example, you show how often you have to check the knife, right? If in Kutzlark the Mashiach checks the knife after doing 100 chickens and finds a nick, it's not such a big deal for them to take the 100 chickens and just send it off to the unkosher line, because in Chutzlaretz there's a tremendous need for non-kosher chickens also. And therefore, the differential between a chicken, so again, the price, the final price is significantly different. But I guess at the non-kosher chickens also have to be killed one way or the other. So if you're talking about at that stage, it's not as big as a loss to the company to take 100 chickens in Chutzlaretz and put them into the trace line, as it is for a company here in Israel to take 100 chickens and put it into the trace line. So if you talk about, if you're just looking at the question of how fast are you shechting, then the standards may be the same. On the other hand, if you look at what's going to happen if a nick was found in the knife, here's where it's a little bit harder to answer, and that again will depend on the mashgiach, and that will depend on the degree of supervision, on the Givya Shamayim of the mashgiach and the plan. How much are they going to insist that, right, there was a problem, or perhaps a problem, and therefore just get rid of these chickens and not? Okay, or for example, the same issue. Say for example, many of the organizations at OU were mostly national, mostly factories, and that's the feeling of the OU, maybe true, maybe not true, but their feeling was that things don't change so simply. You have a factory which is running a production line, they're not going to be a little bit short of tomatoes, they'll go out to the local farm and pick up 50 pounds of tomatoes. And they have their suppliers, they have their routine, they have their own, they're not going to change their ingredients, you know, at the tip of a hat. Here, most food establishments do not run on the same scale. Okay? And many of the kashrut deal with your shawarma place and your pizza place and your here and there who just may need two more tomatoes to get through the day. And therefore, again, the issue of how much, and this is where the issue of mashiach comes in, therefore it's very hard to say, well, this is the same level as it was in Kutzar, because the standard may be even the countries, there are certain things which, so therefore, trying to get a perspective, many of the Kashan Chutzar were in between. If the official standards are usually somewhat higher than, in certain areas, the same thing is a little bit higher than the regular hashgacha, okay? Usually not as much as the mahajin, right? It's sort of viewed typically as somewhere in between. But of course it depends on the particular issue, but the issue here is to what extent is the control and the bisua, the carrying out of regular hashgacha here, the same. Now there's another issue, and this is another interesting point, and that is, in terms of chinuch, I sort of think the same kind of question comes up, and that is, I assume most of our probably grew up in mixed schools. Okay? It's probably also changing now as time goes on, but at the same time, if we look at the schools here, I don't think anybody sends, you have to look, to go find, try to find a place, even from elementary age, where the schools are mixed. And that is an issue that when you talk about hashgachas, when you talk about how I've been trying to emphasize, you realize that there's a whole range of basic hashgachas, and then you have various mahajans which have their own rules and are sometimes competing for how many chumras can we get in, how many more things can we be careful about, and some of them are don't seem so significant, but some are, for example, in terms of milk. One of the main issues, probably many of you know, but one of the main issues in terms of milk between regular milk of kashrut megillah and mahajan milk, one of the issues is Shabbos milk and non-Shabbos. Because the mahajan hashgacha will not allow milk which was done on Shabbos, milking which was done on Shabbos, whereas the regular kashrut will accept from farms or accept from kibbutzim where the milking was done on Shabbos. Other issues would be in terms of how careful in terms of veterinary and in terms of veterinary care of the animals. Again, there's supposed to be a certain basic veterinary, the shots and make them to shape up. But again, the degree of care, the degree of veterinary supervision varies as you grow up. So some of these, or if you turn to the chicken, one of the hottest issues now is that we call it Tomat Hagidin, at the sinus, the bottom of the leg, can make it, to make it, if it's torn, to make animals to a shape up. The current growing where chickens sort of sit in coops and they're fattened up very, very quickly, often there is a higher incidence in the Shulchan Aruch, you will not find anything about this because it was never a problem that was significant to this concern. The current going, there's more of a concern. And therefore, the different kashiyot and different levels of opening is some take a sample, some just check outside, some actually open up each one. So therefore, these are things which keep adding to the price. So there is a whole range, and one of the issues which Rav Ariel has asked a few times about this, when he asked what's mahadrin, in the finish in 2 minutes, it was important that he emphasized when you ask what's mahajan, you have to ask, well, what are you looking for? Right? It's not like you want to say, well, I want to eat mahajan. What do you mean you want to eat mahajan? Right? What does that mean? It's not a black and white. You're worried about this, or you're worried about this, or you want to milk that some things will be mahajan, except for the fact that it has a milk filter. Some things will have some how you do them this way, some going in this way, some tell them how you do them this way. What level, what are you, you know, you have to first ask the question, what standards do you want? Then you can decide, is this mahajan level, is it sufficient? So,
the question is, if someone says in his booklet that he checks Tomei to give him in a certain way.
Right.
This is a far-fetched one, but there are many other rules that I decide that I want to do this, and Ishi Eben Shamayim says that he's checking for this. Do I trust him blindly, or do I need to make sure that I have got someone who tells me who to believe
you to? Trust him blindly, and see if that's going to keep him away from the cash. That's basically what happens. Right, so look, as a consumer, we have to assume, and that's where you sort of have to assume what we see, and that's where you see, we can only go by the doctors that we have. When you have to speak to people more in detail, you get a better sense of this stuff. Yes, that's enough stuff. But again, so I just want to wrap up.
Let's say, if you're finding a whole country which has a kashrut of a different in Havana.
Right.
So, what do you need to learn from it? The difference in Havana is it's less strict with them, and it just gives a kashrut for lower level of kashrut, or
it could be. You have to. It is the fact that you have to. If you were in the middle of a chovet, you find something which is not under Rabbanus chovet, but some other Rabbanus, you would have to ask yourself what's going on.
Well, I have to ask on the other hand, the people who do this
that's what you have to issue. You know, specific thing you have to ask. Okay, so I just wanted to wrap up, just to summarize in terms of tonight. we discussed basically the kasha system, and we pointed out that what is important, that most parats in Israel, almost all parats, have a degree of rabbinical supervision, and that is an important point to remember, to bear in mind. First of all, there are many good Jews who say that's it, okay, it has rabbinical supervision, and as I said, in many ways, when the kashrut, rabbinical kashrut is applied properly, in many situations it's as good as some of the kashrut in chutzpah. Therefore, many people who rely on environment. However, there are some limitations we saw. There are varying degrees of mahajin, which we're not going to have to get into in the future. We'll discuss different specific points of that. What's important to remember in terms of that is that, again, especially if a person always has to make, in terms of any hidur, a person always has to keep in balance what is he giving up for the cost of that hidur. Whether it be in terms of issues, in terms of family, in terms of issue, in terms of the cost, in terms of the issue of availability. But for the same way, if a person is buying an etrog, then he'll ask, you know, well, how much should I spend for the etrog? This is not something which has a specific answer. There are many, many factors which go into the question. What is true, and that I think is true, that if a lot of times you'll have available on the shelf, you will have something which is, you know, next to it, two parts which are almost identical, or price-wise, okay, and one with a Mahajan Ashkafa and one not, so then why not get the Mahajan Ashkafa? Because you are better, you're more secure than to say things were carried out. But what's most important is to at least make sure that everything has a Ashkafa, has a proper Suda. And just the final story is I was in a Malcolm Mall recently. And I started to look around some of the things, so and I was about to say a place which has starting making juices. And then I didn't see a Suda. And I asked him, do you have, who are you under? I said, Rabbanut Suri Shalai, whatever it was. And where is he Suda? Well, there was switching and therefore there were some bureaucrats, whatever, and yet we haven't gotten a new one yet. Okay, this is the kind of thing. It may be true. It may just be something administrative. But as a consumer, it's very, very important to be sure that if you're going with something, you have to make sure that there is in fact a current to that. Okay, so this is a. We'll stop here. Let me.